I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll hear about the Gathering of Nations. It's the country's largest powwow, and it's going on right now in Albuquerque, New Mexico. But first, we have to talk about torture. The questions have always been there in the shadows, part of the ugly underside of the war on terror. Were Americans using interrogation methods that many consider torture? If so, who? And under what circumstances? And under whose authority? And now, as the answers to these questions come to light, they begat even more questions. Should those who engaged in these tactics be held accountable? And if so, which people? And by whom? And as Americans wrap their heads around these morally and legally complex questions, we thought it would be helpful to get some perspective from someone with a deep grounding in military law and ethics. We're going to bring you other such voices in the days ahead, but we're going to start with Eugene Fidel. He's a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Treatment of Enemy Combatants. He's also a visiting professor at Yale University, where he's teaching military law, and he's had a long career representing members of the military on all sides of these questions. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's a privilege.
Gene, I want to ask your opinion about these issues, but before we get to your opinion, I want you to set the table for us. It seems like we're having two parallel conversations, and they're mixed together. On the one hand, there's the actions of CIA agents, intelligence gatherers. On the other hand, there's the question of the military interrogators in Iraq. So I want to take the CIA issue first, because one of the big stories of the week is that the Obama administration decided to release four legal documents from the Bush era that justified extreme interrogation techniques. And in the course of that, it was revealed that two captured al-Qaeda operatives were subjected to waterboarding some 266 times. That practice has since been disallowed. So the question has arisen. The president has said, we don't want to prosecute people who engaged in these tactics if they acted under good faith. But others say the persons who justified these should be held to some sort of account. What is the legal justification for that? Is there a legal precedent for that?
For the legal, for penalizing the attorneys?
People who authorized this conduct.
Certainly, people who have authorized this conduct do have some exposure, basically for having caused torture. Attorneys, speaking as one, typically don't get punished for giving bad legal advice. But in this particular case, the legal advice does seem to be entirely off the wall and authorizing the commission of a crime. Now, we still don't know a lot of the background for how the memoranda issued by Mr. Yu and now Judge Bybee and Mr. Bradbury at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel actually came about and what kind of interaction there was between OLC, as it's called, and other people in the Bush administration. We are likely to know more as, for example, email troves become available. If it is the case that there was a concerted effort to fit the legal advice to a proposed end of inflicting what is torture, then I think there may be some legal exposure on the part, criminal exposure on the part of the people who did that fitting.
What would determine that? If the argument that they sincerely believe that their advice was correct, I mean, what's the determining authority, whether they knowingly encouraged behavior which they had reason to believe was criminal?
There are two aspects to this. One is, what is the subjective state of mind of the individual? A person could be subjectively innocent, let's say. In other words, personally actually believing that what he or she was doing was entirely lawful. And the other is an objective test, whether, as the military standard puts it, a person of ordinary sense and understanding would know that the conduct was not lawful, regardless of what the individual subjectively believed.
But what is lawful changes, doesn't it, depending on the venue? For example, adultery is unlawful in the military. It's not unlawful in any other context. And there are different venues, aren't there, for determining what behavior. There are the criminal courts. There are international human rights courts. If they're out of sync, who decides what's lawful and what's not lawful?
Well, ultimately, it's not the individual that decides. That's the point. There is such a thing as law. There are standards. Not everything is debatable. And I believe that a number of the activities that were authorized and for which an incredible array of circumlocutions and euphemisms is being provided. Enhanced interrogation, for example. I believe that a number of these are undebatably, indisputably torture and therefore indisputably illegal.
Does it matter who is engaging in this conduct, whether are CIA agents subjected to a different standard or should they be then military interrogators?
Nope.
And who decides that?
The respective legal administrations. In the case of the civilian sector, that's the responsibility of course, the Attorney General, but also of President Obama, because it is the president's obligation to take care that the laws are enforced. Now, that doesn't mean the president should be prosecutor in chief, and I think it's desirable that Attorney General Holder function on this. I think that's a very good effort that the president has initiated, that Mr. Holder will consider this. Within the military, it's a little more complicated because it's a more diffuse prosecutorial arrangement where actually commanders rather than attorneys drive the train.
And to that point, I want to play a short clip from a conversation my colleague Robert Siegel had last night with Colonel Stephen Kleinman. He's an Air Force reservist. He's an experienced intelligence officer who talked about what he saw in Iraq in 2003. I want to play a clip of what he said. It's rather lengthy, but I think it's important. So here it is.
I walked into this room. It was a small room with the walls painted black. There was an interrogator sitting in a chair. To his left was an interpreter. The detainee was kneeling with his wrist handcuffed behind his back before the interrogator. Standing behind the interrogator was a guard carrying a, I don't recall now if it's wood or iron rod, and it was almost stereotypical being patted into his hand like a, you know, some B-movie, gangster movie, mm-hmm. if you will. And the questions were posed to the detainee, interpreted. The detainee would answer. The answer was interpreted, and upon that interpretation, the interrogator would slap him across the face. For those who have read the report, they talk about in survival training an insult slap, and it's very, very important to understand that those are affected in a very careful fashion to really shock somebody rather than hurt them. This type of slap was not the same. It was much more forceful. The other difference is it was being delivered systematically, and when I walked mm-hmm. in, I asked how long it had been going on, and I was told 30 minutes. So this individual had been slapped continuously while he was on his knees for 30 minutes.
And I want to point this out that Robert, his questions indicated and the colonel's answers indicated that this wasn't really about seeking information. This was not an effective way to seek information. It seemed to be punitive. It seemed to be for the purpose of inflicting pain on this person in some sort of retributive fashion. But the colonel goes on to say he was very much ostracized for his stance on this point. If this was a widespread practice, and even if these individuals felt that this was the guidance they had been giving, what should happen?
I think there should be punishment. Now, that's with respect to the military side of things. Turning to the civilian side, because as you pointed out, Michelle, there are two dimensions to this. The president has made a decision as a matter of national policy. I believe that it's more important that we have a functional Central Intelligence Agency that can move ahead and help perform the its responsibilities, which are doubtless highly important. But I think punishment is a key part of having a government of law. I also think it's important that we not be afraid of looking back in appropriate circumstances. And in this connection, I'd like to quote something that appears in this morning's Washington Post. It's a direct quote. "Today and every day, we have an opportunity as well as an obligation to confront these scourges, to fight the impulse, to turn the channel when we see images that disturb us or wrap ourselves in the false comfort that others' sufferings are not our own." That's a quote from President Obama yesterday, speaking of Holocaust Remembrance Day. I think that's pertinent in the present context as well.
Well, then let's move to your opinion about what should happen now. The president, President Obama, there seems to be some ambivalence in this administration about how to go forward. On the one hand, Mr. Obama and others have said that line officers, people who acted in good faith, under the direction of their supervisor shouldn't be prosecuted. On the other hand, he also seems to have ruled out the idea of a some sort of a truth commission along the lines of the – or an independent commission along the lines of the 9/11 commission, because he says it would be a political distraction. But he's also said that the attorney, he has authorized the attorney general to go where the facts lead him. What is your view about what should go forward? What should happen?
There's no question that the president has an enormous amount on his plate right now, and the administration has an enormous amount on its plate. The country has to be on fire about the economy, and we all understand that. But I think the country is capable of doing more than one important thing at a time, and this is a very important thing. Personally, I believe it would be a colossal mistake to walk away from having a proper independent investigation. I don't believe we've heard the last word from the president on that subject. I hope that we have not heard the last
word. What would it serve? What purpose would it serve? I mean, there are a number of distinguished individuals like Senator John McCain who say that this would, that prosecuting, particularly the individuals who offered advice, would inhibit the ability of persons to give advice to the president. It sets a terrible precedent.
No, I don't. I respectfully disagree with Senator McCain. I think Senator, for one thing, I think attorneys and Senator McCain has other skills, but he's not an attorney. I don't think attorneys would feel chilled by the prospect of an investigation. I think it's terribly important for the country. It's important for the CIA. It's important for the military. It's important for the world that we have an investigation. That doesn't mean that we would be committed to prosecuting anybody, but we cannot make an informed judgment as a society with respect to prosecution or further steps to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future unless we have a really, really firm take on what happened. And we don't have that yet.
Eugene Fidel is an attorney. He's a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Treatment of Enemy Combatants. He's also a visiting professor at Yale University, where he is teaching military law. And as I mentioned earlier, he has had a long career in representing members of the military engaged in all manner of concerns, including ethics and military ethics and matters pertaining to the battlefield. He was kind enough to join us from our Washington, D.C. studios. Mr. Fidel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.